What's up, Bitcoiners? I'm super excited to announce that Lendin will be our first sponsor. Over the last few weeks, I've gotten to meet and have some great conversations with Maurizio, the co-founder of Lendin.io, about him and Lendin and what they are building over there. Lendin.io provides savings and credit products built for Bitcoin, and they are unlocking the potential for bringing Bitcoin as an amazing asset that you can collateralize to get loans against all across the globe. Lendin is not only disrupting the traditional loan-based economy, but their mission is to have worldwide reach, which is really awesome. Maurizio is originally from Venezuela, and Lendin.io is focused on understanding his experiences and those of their users and having to store and transmit value across time and space. It's clear to me that Lendin is listening to what their users are saying and bringing products to market that help. I can't wait to share more about Lendin.io with you over the next few months. And now, let's enter the Matrix with Nick Bhatia, where we talk all about financial panics, the hierarchy of money, and climbing the monetary pyramid during times of economic crises.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Nick Bhatia is a financial researcher, CFA charterholder, and adjunct professor of finance and business economics at the University of Southern California Marshall School of Securities, where he teaches applied finance and fixed income securities. Previously, Nick worked the US Treasury's trading desk for a large institutional asset manager and has extensive trading experience in money markets and interest rate futures. After starting his teaching career, Nick felt the urge to bring his research on both the international monetary system and Bitcoin together as one to write layered money, from gold and dollars to Bitcoin and central bank digital currencies. He has a BA in social sciences from USC and a master's in finance from IE Business School in Madrid, Spain. Nick Bhatia, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. What is up?
What's up, Cedric? Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm super excited to have you on the show. I just finished the book a couple of days ago and I was really impressed. I learned a lot. But beyond the historical context that I gleaned from the book, I learned a lot about layered money and how our current financial system actually works. I think the implications of credit and balance sheets. So I'd really love to get into it. But first, I'd love to hear more about your background. How did you end up teaching finance, working in finance, trading?
So I ended up in trading and in finance because it has always been my primary interest and focus. So, you know, as early as a teenager, taking economics classes in high school and just being very passionate about the markets and geopolitics led me into the investment industry, into fixed income, interest rates, and trading. You know, how I ended up in teaching, it's a funny story. It's not something that I imagined doing, but when I was on the trading desk, the guy who sat next to me set me up for just a coffee with a friend. And he was an adjunct professor at USC Marshall, and they were looking for people to come in and guest lecture for a hedge funds class and a derivatives class and also a fixed income class. So they needed somebody with investment experience that, you know, could teach the kids something unique and kind of off curriculum. And so I put together a few lectures as a guest lecturer. One was on the 30-year part of the US yield curve and the structural demand. It was called the structural demand for duration, meaning there is a fundamental bid for 30-year US treasuries. And there is a reason for it. There's a demographic reason for it. There's a structural reason in the fixed income market itself. And there are nuanced reasons as well. But there's a very strong bid for 30-year U.S. Treasuries, and it's not something that a college student is in tune with. And so that was a unique topic that I taught. And other, you know, similar nuanced fixed income and investment topics. Within a few months, the fixed income professor, tenured professor at USC, wanted to go from 4 down to 3 classes and essentially grandfathered me his course. Mm. And they offered me the position of adjunct professor at USC. And it was a spectacular honor for me. I went to USC for undergrad. My dad and grandfather both have degrees from USC. So it's something that goes back 70 years in my family, being a USC Trojan. And so it was something that I couldn't turn down. And I used it as an opportunity to resign from an active investment management role and to pursue academia, to pursue a career as a teacher, as a writer, and as a researcher. And it ended up with Layered Money, but it didn't start as that. It started with me just trying to flip off the active fiduciary role and turning on a researcher mindset full time.
Yeah, it's very interesting what you bring to the table as a professor. I happen to have had a very positive experience getting my bachelor's in finance and with a minor in accounting. And I look back on a lot of my professors, I learned a lot. I do have a lot of questions about the lack of, say, Austrian economics and a lot of the economics science that was offered in the university. And I'd like to know your opinion now of how universities and colleges might be approaching economics and finance. Do you think, or maybe I'm misguided, but has there been an improvement? Do you think there's more open-minded professors? Because I read your book. I think that you're probably a fantastic professor, as great as the professors I had, maybe better. And so I think there is a lot of intelligence in these centers. And I'm just curious what your reflection has been on the experience.
My personal experience studying economics in undergrad at USC was that it's very narrow. And in the classes and the electives that I was able to get my brain going and challenge some of the things, it wasn't a raging success for me. I did have one bond professor. He's also a CFA charter holder. He's the person who kind of turned the light bulb on the CFA track. And he was a college professor for me. That was great. But it was at that point, Cedric, that I realized I had studied the wrong thing. And I should not have studied economics. I should have studied finance. And so I pursued a master in finance to formalize that education and to capture what I wanted to. And so I think that might be the answer to your question, is that the way that finance is taught today, I think you have forward thinkers and you have practitioners a lot more. Like myself, I teach in the business school in the finance department. I do not teach in the economics department, and I'm not affiliated with the, you know, USC Marshall is the business school. It's not affiliated with the economics department, which is in the College of Letters, Arts, and Sciences, which is where I have my degree from. And I studied a lot of political science in college and international relations. And that's why my degree is in social sciences and not econ, because it was econ plus poli sci plus IR. That was how I got, that was where my interest was. It was in geopolitics. Then I really realized that it's the financial markets and finance that's my interest, not economics per se. And so, you know, and that happened at, 22, 23 years old. So it wasn't something that I realized right away at all.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic. I did gravitate also, well, I did gravitate to finance in undergrad, and I got my master's in accounting. The economic stuff was really interesting. I just couldn't find or put my finger on the pulse of truth in those schools at the time. I'm kind of curious, why was it so important for you to write this book now and get this story out?
Yeah, it really came down to, you know, this decision to leave the trading desk. And if I was going to leave the trading desk, I had to make my mark in a different way, because I had developed a strong reputation as a U.S. Treasuries trader that, you know, was able to trade volume with large counterparties for a large fiduciary, you know, as a fiduciary for large clients, you know, talk rates with the finest minds on the street, something that I really built up for myself. And it wasn't something that I wanted to just leave behind. I needed to convert that reputation into something physical, and I needed to do it within a short enough time span. And so it took 16 months from leaving the desk to publishing Layered Money and, you know, sending it to my colleagues on the street, as well as, you know, everybody else around the world.
Yeah. What kind of effort and sacrifice did it take to writing the book? I imagine you had to give up a lot of golf and maybe a little red wine in the evenings.
Golf stopped for the entirety of writing the book. So I took the year off from, you know, one of the hobbies that I value a lot. The red wine was also much less, because there were a lot of late night writing sessions. And so, you know, to answer your question, the sacrifice was all encompassing, personally, from my family's perspective, from an income perspective, because I, you know, left a stable job. The sacrifice was all encompassing.
Yeah.
It took 8 months of absolute dedication, morning and night, completely taking over my brain, not really being able to do anything else, because I knew I had to, once I made the decision to write the book, then all other opportunities have to be put aside. Mm. And then you're actually all in on the book. And that is what happened to me and my family. You know, I have a wife and 3-year-old daughter. And so at that point, as a family, you're all in on the book, and there's no option to fail at that point.
Yeah. Well, I'm so thankful you wrote the book. One of the key terms I took away from it is monetary science. And could you explain what is monetary science? And because I don't think a lot of people think about things this way.
Yeah. Monetary science is this idea that our monetary system and our financial system are obscured away by counterparties, instruments, and labels. But amongst all that, there's a science to it, because the alternative is just barter, gold coins, let's use as an example. And I want something, I give you coins, you give me the thing, and that's the end. There's no monetary science in the exchange or barter of things.
Right.
We use commercial banks, central banks, payment processors, monetary policy, which is the introduction of price controls over money and money issuance, quantity of money issuance. All these things are science now. It's studied in academia, in economics departments. It's continued in economic think tanks, which are filled with the PhDs, you know, that have left professorship and have gone on to, you know, bridge the academia and central banking worlds. And then you have the central bankers themselves, which are, you know, up until Jay Powell, PhDs, and part of this scientific study that starts in, you know, economics departments at American universities for the large part. So that whole science is, you know, they have a dogma, right? And then there's also the alternative to that dogma. And that's why Saifedean Ammous's book is so popular, because it's an attempt to refute the monetary science as it stands today. And I think that was valued. There's, you know, a very popular website called zerohedge.com, which stands to question at all times the dogma of the monetary science. And Zero Hedge has evolved into, you know, mostly a junkyard of postings, but there still are valuable rhetorical opposite statements to the dogma. So the monetary science is something that we have to identify that it exists, but it is evolving and it can be questioned and there can be opposite theories. That's why we have Keynesian and Austrian economics as two different perspectives in the monetary science, and it's important that they both exist.
Right. I like how you bring up that there are different perspectives and it's evolving and that we can question it. And the current, I would say that the current dogma is incredibly confusing, and we're so distanced from the monetary science or the evolution of the layers of money. And most of us reside or interact with maybe just the lowest level of money. So maybe we could start from the beginning, or at least the beginning of layered money. And can you tell us what the significance of the gold florin was to this story?
Yeah, the gold florin is incredibly significant because it was the first time that a coin developed a pan-continental reputation that allowed for a banking network to build on top of promises in that coin. The florin was unchanged in its purity for over 300 years. And so bankers and a banking network said, you know, I owe you florin, not in 30 days necessarily or 90 days, but I owe you florin in 1 to 10 years. And I know that the florins that are minted in 10 years will be the same as the ones today, and that the unit will be stable. And so it set the groundwork for a league of promises to develop that really couldn't have developed before that, because of constantly changing coin purities and coin multiplicity, really, in that every little locality has their own mint.
Yeah. What I found so fascinating about the gold florin is just how many parallels I drew to Bitcoin, just in terms of, and the story for Bitcoin hasn't been written, but we're talking about 400 years of economic stability. And what I really struck me was just that when we talked about how the northern Italian cities of Florence, Venice, Genoa, and Pisa established themselves as city republics after breaking free from their feudal overlords during the 11th century, and their newfound independence was later followed by the coinage of their own money, I couldn't help but think of citadels or like city states or the future of our world. And I find that this is a really interesting place to start the story. And what I'm kind of curious about here is, what is deferred settlement and why is it so crucial for trade? Because you kind of brought that up a little bit before.
Yeah, you know, let's go back to our example of I give you a gold coin and you give me the thing. Well, you know, I might not have all the money in my pocket at all times. And especially for large purchases. And so we have to have a system of trust so that we can move money quicker than just, you know, me giving you a gold coin and thinking that that's the end of the transaction. Especially if we have a relationship, a business relationship, we can defer settlement of payment to a later date in order to take care of our business. Because what's least important in our transaction is that you get metal from me. What's most important is that I get the product and you are able to take my promise to pay you and go re-up on your supply or your raw materials and make the economy move. So deferred settlement is essential. It's this concept that I owe you this and we can settle it later, but let's make the economy move now. Because I might not have all the physical gold coins that I need to make this transaction happen. And actually, it's not even that I might not have them because they're bulky or they're heavy, or I don't want to take them out of my mattress at home. But it's also that I might not even have any money to start. But if you sell me cloth and I say, I'll pay you back later, I can take the cloth, turn it into clothes, sell the clothes, make a profit, pay you back. And we've just created economic growth out of thin air. And so this is where I differ from some Austrian economists that think that we need a 100% reserve currency, or that a debt money system is a detriment to our society. No, debt money and money creation is essential for economic growth. And I even think for innovation and just moving forward our society, but it's the over leverage. It's the dangerous leverage, and all that can cause the detriment to society. So there's a balance there that we have not struck today. We've gone way to the one extreme. And I think we have to come back to a more sound money world. But that doesn't mean 100% reserved, no credit, and no credit money system. We'll still need a layered credit money system. It's just that I hope Bitcoin serves as the anchor because of the discipline that it can potentially exercise on the world, where, you know, government money cannot.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. I mean, you're referring to the base layer of money, velocity, you know, debt, the discipline of hard money in the base layer. What I really gleaned from your book, not really like the only thing, but one of the things that really struck was that this layered money starts from the top down. When we talk about a monetary pyramid, my inclination is to think about the base layer at the bottom. And when we talk about credit though and discipline, can you kind of elaborate or tell us the significance of Fibonacci's sort of bringing his ideas in the Book of Calculation from other parts of the world, and how that gave birth to a new merchant class and where their power came from?
Yeah, Fibonacci brought a lot of mathematic and accounting techniques from Northern Africa across the Mediterranean. And what happened after Fibonacci introduced, basically he introduced the Hindu Arabic numeral system to Europe, which was still on the Roman numeral system, as well as the accounting techniques that went along with that new numerical system. And the advances in mathematics and accounting, it really gave birth to this idea of merchant bankers, people that could create a business line out of accounting and balance sheets, and using these accounting techniques to lend money, create money, and create credit. So His contribution was very valuable, and it was compounded by a later formalization of double entry accounting, which really can trace back to Fibonacci and some of the techniques that he brought across the Mediterranean at the time.
Yeah. How do bankers use their balance sheet to create money versus, say, minting a coin?
Yeah, it really comes down to can the deposit that they issue be treated as money out in the population? And if the answer is yes, then they can create money out of thin air. Because if I lend you money, let's say when Wells Fargo lends money and they create a deposit in somebody in a checking account for somebody, that checking account deposit from Wells Fargo is going to be treated as money outside in the American economy. And so Wells Fargo just needed to type that money in and therefore created the money out of thin air, but it's backed by the promise that you pay Wells Fargo in the future. So they strike an asset on their balance sheet when they lend you the money, and that's how money is created.
Yeah, you kind of touched on it there, but if maybe you could explain how in the hierarchy of money, how is paper money different than, say, a gold coin?
Yeah, you know, it comes down to the most rudimentary example of layered money, a gold coin and a gold certificate that says, I promise to pay the gold coin. The gold coin is treated as money, but the gold certificate, if it's issued by, let's say, the United States of America Treasury Department, it's also going to be treated as money because people trust the issuer. And so at face value, they might look and feel equal to each other. But from a historical perspective and from an accounting hierarchy perspective, the gold coin and the gold certificate are not the same thing. In fact, the gold certificate is junior in the hierarchy of money to the coin because it's a promise to pay the coin. And so the promise equals the hierarchy. It's the hierarchy equals a system of promises, and the promises are in a structure of balance sheets. So the layered money system, our money hierarchy, is a hierarchy of balance sheets of financial institutions. And so fast forward to today, the basic three layered money system that we have is that your Wells Fargo checking account deposits are a third layer of money issued by a commercial bank, which has Federal Reserve balances, deposits on as their assets. The Federal Reserve deposits are the liability of the Fed and therefore the second layer of money. And the Fed owns US Treasuries as the first layer of money on the asset side of their balance sheet. So first layer, US Treasury securities, second layer, Federal Reserve deposits called reserves, which are the banking system's deposits, and then checking account deposits, commercial deposits, which are, you know, the money of the populace. But when you look at them in the, when you look at checking account deposits in the hierarchy of money, we can see that Wells Fargo checking account dollars are not the same thing as US Treasury securities. In fact, they're separated by two balance sheets.
Yeah, very interesting. I think we're alluding to the differences between retail and wholesale cash or wholesale money, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But how do you define cash today? I mean, most of us just think about it as the paper money in our wallets.
Well, yeah, and this is something that I toyed with a little bit in the book, but I didn't dive too deeply into it because the word cash now, I could have written a chapter about what does the word cash mean? So, yeah, I mean, from the traditional perspective, the word cash means Federal Reserve notes or, you know, money that's issued by the central bank on the second layer of money. But we know now that cash, from an investment perspective, is the alternative to risk. And that's really the important thing here when looking at the financial system. And what I think about as a liquidity premium on US treasuries, which is, it's the additional demand for treasuries beyond wanting the creditworthiness of the US government. You have a liquidity premium in that US treasuries trade like a cash-like instrument more than anything else in the world. And so there's a premium to own that. And therefore interest rates are lower than they otherwise might be because the demand for US treasuries is higher than just for the creditworthiness of the government. And why is it? It's because the investment universe, everything with risk, credit risk or counterparty risk, any banking liability, any bond that's not a US treasury, when you don't want that, you want cash. And so what is cash? Treasuries. And so there's this really nuanced definition of cash, which has to be framed as an investment manager, which is the alternative to risk. And it goes way beyond paper money or even a money market fund, which, as we know, you know, is not the same thing as US Treasury security, although they can behave wildly similarly. But you know, when push comes to shove, it's not the same thing.
Got it. In terms of like the hierarchy of money or layered money framework, you mentioned like when you don't want that, you want cash. What does it mean to climb the pyramid of money during a time of economic crisis?
It means you're selling something to buy something of a higher order of money. And so if you are in 19th century England and you have as your cash, as your money, a bunch of pieces of paper that say, I owe you 20 pounds, 50 pounds, 100 pounds, and it's written and issued by some private banker, you do not have the same type of cash as if another person had Bank of England notes. And so if you question the creditworthiness of the private banker who issued you that piece of paper, you will sell that piece of paper and try to obtain Bank of England notes. And that, in the layered money framework, is climbing the pyramid from a lower layer to a higher layer, because the private banker has issued you a promise to pay those Bank of England notes. And if you don't think he's going to pay, you sell them and you buy Bank of England notes, and you're climbing the pyramid of money in order to seek a higher form of money. But you're really not, you're not trying to seek a higher form. You're actually trying to eliminate one balance sheet of exposure, the private banker. And that's why you climb, because you climb over the balance sheet of, you know, you of exposure that right. you have.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. It really kind of like illuminated to me the scramble for security during times of crisis and sort of the prioritization or how we value our money through the layers. And I think that was really interesting and compelling. I also, you know, I learned a lot about the price discovery of money. Can you talk a little bit about how these markets form, the first markets that kind of dealt in money and traded yeah. money?
Well, let's go back to this English example. I have a piece of paper that's issued by a private banker that says, I owe you 10 pounds. And I actually want 10 pounds issued by the Bank of England, right? So I have to sell one piece of paper and buy the other paper. Well, what's the price of that piece of paper? Is it 10? No, it's actually not 10, because it's lower in the hierarchy. The price of the 10-pound note issued by the Bank of England is 10. The price of the 10-pound promise issued by a private banker is less than 10. And that's what the price discovery of money is. It's what is the price of that piece of paper if it's not 10? Is it $9? Is it £9.99? Is it £8? You know, is it somewhere in between? And how do we find out the price? You go to the market and you say, what will you pay? Right? Because I'd rather have 9 Bank of England pound notes than 10 pounds issued by this guy.
Right.
And so that price is the price discovery of money. And all monetary instruments eventually face price discovery. But in our world today, unfortunately, the central banks have papered over potential losses so much so that so many things trade at par, meaning everything trades at 10 that says I promise to pay 10. And if everything pays 10, you know, or trades at 10 that promises to pay 10, how do we know what's real money and what's not? Where can we get confused by that? And this is a huge part of the problem with the US dollar system. We are not allowed to let the market tell us what the different prices of the different monies are. And that is a detriment, I think, to the proper functioning of financial system. It's what we're locked into now. And I don't even blame the Fed for doing it, because if they didn't do it, the whole thing would break and the financial system would have to collapse to rebuild itself as banks around the world would fail and all that. So I don't think that that's a great solution, which is, again, why I'm not complaining about what the Fed is doing. I rather like the Bitcoiner terminology that this is our exit. Mm-hmm. And that's my attitude. And I share it with a lot of people. Instead of, you know, saying the Fed should let all the banks fail, well, from a societal perspective, I don't necessarily agree with that. Let them do that. We now have an exit. It's Bitcoin. We can build a new, better financial system on top of it. That's my goal. That's what I pursue in my writing, and I plan to pursue going forward.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I think you bring a lot of levity to this subject of sort of hyper-Bitcoinization and where the dollar's going and what the impacts would be. And I think that, you know, thinking through your book, you kind of express a lot of that in terms of how these markets work, the longevity of these markets, and the impact that they have on society. And you touched a bit about the time value of money there. You'd rather have, you know, money up front now in Bank of England notes than this guy's note. What is the art of arbitrage when we're in this situation? And I'm assuming we don't see it as much today because everything's trading at par.
Well, you know, so you are right. It is very difficult to arbitrage interest rates these days. You have to take massive leverage in order to do it because the spread to arbitrage is very small. That is because of a couple of things. One of them is central banking policy, but another is the electronification of markets and the electronification of trading as well has reduced a lot of that arbitrage away from the market. But again, that's actually, it's part of the problem is that the Fed has backstopped everything. So nobody's willing to sell to face price discovery and so that an arbitrageur can come in and capture that and make money. But, you know, that wasn't always the case. You think about the pit in the Antwerp Bourse where all these promises are flying around. An arbitrageur might know something about some of the counterparties and be able to buy at 7, sell at 8, and capture a spread. And, you know, that is still what traders do today. They're still trying to capture a spread. But the art of arbitrage has changed a lot. You know, in the brief time that I've been in the markets, and I would recommend everybody go read When Genius Failed. It's a book that I reference in Layered Money about the long-term capital management hedge fund failure that, you know, we experienced 20 years ago that was a prelude to the 08 financial crisis. And if you're curious at all about the word arbitrage and its place in today's financial markets, that's a really important history book.
Yeah, I mean, LTCM was really seminal in my life. So I was in college during the time and we actually studied it from an academic perspective and it just blew my mind. It just, there were no rules being followed and it just was apparent the game was rigged in a lot of ways.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and that was a huge moral dilemma for me in terms of, do I pursue a career in this field where, you know, I know things are rigged in my favor, you know, or do I go embark on something else? And not that those areas or industries are not rigged. But there was a moral dilemma there. I'm kind of, you know, but speaking about money and sort of lack of price discovery, how did governments move in to take control over the pivotal position between first and second layers of money?
It started in Amsterdam. You know, the city of Amsterdam was a special place and a special time in that they had the responsibility of developing a clearing system for the trading of shares in the Dutch East India Company, which is the first ever joint stock company. And so a really unique position. And because of all the trading that took place in the first ever stock exchange, the Amsterdam Bourse, there needed to be an advanced settlement mechanism instead of all these different paper promises or even coins. And so the Bank of Amsterdam was created in order to bring all transactions in-house. Gold and silver was not seized per se, but it was captured and issued a deposit against. And it was mandated that the Bank of Amsterdam deposit was used as the currency unit within the Amsterdam Bourse and other transactions. Basically, you couldn't use gold coins, you couldn't use silver coins, you couldn't use gold and silver certificates issued by random private bankers. You had to use the Dutch florin issued by the Bank of Amsterdam. And it was to address a public need, an economic public need. And so this didn't serve mom and pop, it served the financial industry, which is, you know, it's an important precedent for sure. And something that we can like look back and smile about and you know, maybe trace some of the crony capitalism that we see today back to the Amsterdam, Bank of Amsterdam. And I did try to make that known, you know, when I'm writing Layered Money, to show that this is a privileged loan to the Dutch East India Company, the city of Amsterdam, and it's held on par with all this gold that was taken from the public and issued deposits against. So a very interesting moment in history.
Yeah, I thought it was a very, yeah, like I said, very interesting moment in history. It made me think of Executive Order 6102. I just sort of dwelled on that for a minute, where I wondered how much they studied what happened in Amsterdam and with the Bank of England and mimicked those things versus independent discovery or just happenstance. It seems like these things repeat themselves, these maneuvers, these I don't want to call them tricks, but.
And I will say just real quickly that, you know, writing this book from 1913 to the present and to the future, I had that part of the story largely figured out. Not that I didn't have to do research or work while writing it, but I had that part figured out in my head before starting to write the book. The 800 years before that, I had no idea what the story was or even where to start it, what point in time to start it. And so everything from Florence to Amsterdam was a learning process for me. And I had actually read Walter Badgett's treatise on money markets, which he wrote in the 1800s. I had read that book last 2 years ago. And that's when I realized that the art of central banking, you know, goes back before the Fed and the lender of last resort concept and the hierarchy of money itself goes back way before the Fed. And so it opened my eyes to trying to figure out what the story of layered money was, trying to figure out where to start it. So that, six to 800 years of European history that I wrote about in chapters 1, 2, and 3 of Layered Money was probably the most fun that I had in the process of writing, because it was truly a research discovery period for myself. And so I'll always cherish that for sure.
Yeah, I could see that. I'm really curious how you balance your interests and your research. I might be a little narrow-minded or one track-minded, where if I'm doing kind of Bitcoin reading or research, I'm not really thinking about the legacy system maybe too much. There might be a bridge once in a while, but it's kind of like I'm doing my Bitcoin work. And if I were to like study what was going on in it, I would think of it as like, I'm not doing Bitcoin now, I'm doing this other thing. For you, is it similar to that? Or is there always constant connections back and forth? Do you battle with, I'd rather learn about Bitcoin than the old world right now? Or does learning about the old world inform Bitcoin for you? Is there a disconnect there?
Yeah, you've asked a question that has an answer that's probably more personal than anything that, you know, I usually share. But I have a very obsessive compulsive personality when it comes to just like my intellectual pursuit. I'm crazy. I jump around. So, yes, I mean, I'm kind of like you. It's harder for me to have a lot of things going on in my brain, especially when I'm trying to pursue the deepest of thought and the most impactful of thought. So, for example, right now, while I have several things on my research radar, including on-chain Bitcoin metrics, something that I'm kind of obsessed with at the moment in trying to learn more about, and then valuing Bitcoin and being able to try to explain Bitcoin's value more holistically when you move away from on-chain. So there's on-chain, but there's the other stuff. So all of that is in my wheelhouse. I'm doing a lot of research into, I'm working with ZBD, the gaming company, on a paper. And so I'm down this metaverse rabbit hole right now. And actually it's opened my eyes to so many things that I never thought about. With all that being said, my obsession right now is Chinese cultural and political history, stretching back 5,000 years so that I can get context for what we are facing as the next 10 to 20 years in our geopolitical scene, US v. China and the whole world and where we're heading. And that has to do with Bitcoin, has to do with CBDCs. It has everything to do with Bitcoin though. But just to answer your question, like I can't get past that in terms of what is dominating my mind share. So it's my biggest struggle. It's why I'm so thankful that I'm not on the desk anymore so that my brain can have the room. Mm-hmm. And I also tried to not put too much pressure on myself to focus on one thing or to come out with a conclusion that I value, that I think is important. I spent my whole life trying to figure out what the thesis was for the first book. Like I always wanted to write a book. But when I was 19, the book that I wanted to write was about my family's migration from India to the United States. And so like layered money and that is nothing to do with each other, but I didn't put pressure on myself to reach the conclusion. I just kept pursuing. Then I knew it would be financial related. Then at a certain point, I knew it would also be Bitcoin related. And I found the thesis. So I'm looking for my second one. It might take years.
Yeah. Wow. It's very interesting with the China stuff. And maybe we'll touch on that in a little bit. I'm really curious when you started thinking about money in this layered or hierarchical fashion. And what I mean by that, I mean, you've always been financially, economically inclined, numbers, accounting, whatever it might be. But there's a really big difference. And I think a huge leap between trying to master a trade, game a system, figure out where you belong, how you can add value, and how does this whole thing work? And how does this thing work in a way that other people are not even looking at it? When did your attention turn to that? And I'm just really curious here, was that before or after Bitcoin?
Yeah, definitely after. And so, okay, there are about three steps that got me to layered money. The first was QE. And QE started in 09 or 10, kind of like ramped up. And in 2010, I wanted to understand what was QE. And I was in college, right? And when I'm like, what is QE? What is this money printing? And I realized, what is QE? It's when the Fed buys treasuries. And that just opened my mind. It just like made me try to understand the whole monetary system. Like if all the media can talk about is QE, QE, QE. What is QE? It's when the Fed buys treasuries. I need to understand that, right? And so the Fed's balance sheet, which is the first and second layer of money in our current financial system, the Fed's balance sheet was my first area of study, 2010, right? Way before I had ever heard of Bitcoin, let alone started my study. And pursuing that understanding of the Fed's balance sheet really like put me in a great position to have the layered money story tell itself later on, because then, you know, that's my foundation is the Fed's balance sheet, right? So going to Spain, studying finance, studying for my CFA. Now I always had the Fed's balance sheet as a structure to frame the rest of my study. So that put me in a really good position. The second step was discovering Bitcoin and really discovering Lightning Network at the same time as I was discovering Bitcoin, because when I was down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, it was during the SegWit war. So Everybody go read The Block Size War and, you know, learn your Bitcoin history. But 2016, 2017 was my initiation to Bitcoin. So SegWit, understanding what SegWit was just as important as understanding what the Bitcoin blockchain was or what mining was, because it was at the center of the debate. It was like, this is what Bitcoin can be. It can be Bitcoin plus SegWit plus Lightning, which is way different than Bitcoin. I mean, it's way more advanced. It's not different. It's advanced. It's upgraded. And so understanding Lightning Network was a huge challenge to me because I didn't know what Bitcoin was either. So my Bitcoin study was intensified by trying to understand Lightning Network and to understand SegWit's impact and importance in order to pave the way for Lightning Network. I did all of that at the same time. And so that put me to understand a second layer Bitcoin versus first layer Bitcoin. So then the word layer is introduced for the first time to me from this perspective. Step three, November 2019, two or three months after I resigned from my position as a bond trader, I read a paper by Professor Perry Merling, which I've cited in the book and I've talked about in several interviews, The Inherent Hierarchy of Money, in which Merling presents a three-layered money monetary system as a hierarchy of balance sheets between gold, government currency, and commercial deposits as a theoretical framework to understand how our monetary system works. The paper blew my mind. I changed my whole curriculum as an adjunct professor to introduce this framework to my students. And I immediately started thinking about Lightning Network, like midway through the paper. I gave a talk in November 2019 to a Lightning Network meetup in Los Angeles, where I introduced the hierarchy of money as a Bitcoin concept as well. And then about 4 months later, I began work on the book, Layered Money.
Yeah, fantastic. I do have the quote from Perry Merling: always and everywhere, monetary systems are hierarchical. I could see how that would set the course. I'm kind of curious, you know, are financial panics pretty much guaranteed in a money pyramid?
They are, because you're basically, in order to avoid financial panic in a fractionally reserved system, you have to avoid either misguided risk-taking or, have a guarantor to prevent collapse. It's just inevitable in a fractional system. And it's also an important question when you set up, why is our dollar system doomed? it's doomed because fractional systems are meant to have failures in them. And when you prevent the failures, which is what the Fed is doing, the system can't heal itself. It just has permanent bandages on. And again, there's a balance there that we have to figure out as a society.
Yeah.
And it would be ridiculous for me to say I have the answer to that. What is the right leverage ratio? What is the right fractional amount? Who are the right parties to be involved in credit issuance? What I do know is that Bitcoin as a monetary asset and as an anchor for a monetary system is an unprecedented advance and a once in a millennium type of event and something very special. And it is why I've chosen to pursue a career in Bitcoin research full-time, because I genuinely believe that Bitcoin changes our future. And it does that by setting some foundation for a new monetary system better than the one we have today. How exactly will it be better? You know, that's something that it's beyond the scope of a 1-hour chat. It's beyond the scope of Twitter or, you know, a few articles. It's more of a lifelong pursuit. And I'm honored to be on that journey with great Bitcoiners around the world. Bitcoiners are, you know, there's some of the best parts about being in Bitcoin, being among all these people that are way smarter than me from, you know, the software perspective, you know, philosophically, you know, people that do the hard work, like, you know, when Alex Gladstein writes about human rights and, you know, the hard work that he does on the ground doing research, you know, all the devs making Taproot a reality, you know, all the people designing ASICs, and, you know, there's just so many people that are brilliant, and a lot of us just have a goal to make the world better, actually. And so it is an honor to be on the journey with all those okay. people.
Yeah, I think unfortunately I take them all for granted. I mean, they're just doing so much hard work, and we get to sit back and be armchair psychologists and philosophers. But while you were talking about it, I do think I take some of that for granted. But that's happening, and they're busting their butt to make this network better.
And I'll tell you why. I think part of the reason why is that we all love number go up, and that brings us all together. But that's not a pursuit. That's actually a result of all of the hard work.
Right.
And so it's what everybody else cares about. Mm-hmm. I love the bear markets because they allow for the focus. I wrote the time value Bitcoin, you know, in the depths of the bear market, and I you know, wrote Layered Money. I started Layered Money at, you know, 5K Bitcoin. And so it's better for the builders for the price to be lower.
Yeah.
When the price goes up, it's more fun. And then we, you know, lose sight of the work that, you know, we all did in the bear market.
Yeah.
And we're all responsible for Bitcoin. We all, you know, it's, you know, I don't have anything to do with the technology. I have something to do with the PR, and the devs aren't, you know, doing the PR that I'm doing. So it's a team effort. And, you know, the hard work, you know, the hard work has been done already by Satoshi and Hal Finney, and then the early believers, the early builders that got it to the level that it could reach exponential adoption. Now the exponential adoption, that part is easy. It's easy for me to write a book about Bitcoin being a victorious young asset, 12 years old, because for 11 years there were people doing all the heavy lifting. So but it, you know, it's fun to be a part of it, and it's fun to be networked with people like Adam Back, that paved the way for Satoshi himself.
Right. I agree. You bring up Hal Finney, Adam Back. I want to read some of the words that you included that Hal wrote in 2010. In 2010, Finney provided a particularly fascinating explanation of how Bitcoin layered money might evolve, a prognosis ahead of its time. His quote almost feels like it was custom written for Nick's book. Actually, there is a very good reason for Bitcoin-backed banks to exist. Issuing their own digital cash currency redeemable for Bitcoins. Bitcoin itself cannot scale to have every single financial transaction in the world be broadcast to everyone and included in the blockchain. There needs to be a secondary level of payment systems, which is lighter weight and more efficient. Likewise, the time needed for Bitcoin transactions to finalize will be impractical for medium to large value purchases. Bitcoin-backed banks will solve these problems. They can work like banks did before nationalization of currency. Different banks can have different policies, some more aggressive, some more conservative. Some would be fractional reserve, while others may be 100% Bitcoin backed. Interest rates may vary. Cash from some banks may trade at a discount to that from others. I believe this will be the ultimate fate of Bitcoin, to be the high powered money that serves as a reserve currency for banks that issue their own digital cash. Again, Hal wrote that in 2010. It blows my mind, some of the prognostications he came up with in 2009 and 2010. It makes me feel that he thought very deeply about these things for long before Bitcoin existed. And it kind of makes me feel like he invented Bitcoin just because he was thinking so far ahead about something that he might have seen before others did. I mean, he had a time, it seems like, it feels like he had a time to reflect. But to get back to the material of the book, what is the difference between wholesale and retail money?
I'm sorry, but it just makes me smile so much, the Finney stuff, because it was one of the few times that I got goosebumps writing the book, because obviously those were not my words. But actually, you know, interestingly enough, that exact quote was in the Time Value Bitcoin, my 2018 research article. It didn't make it into the final piece. It got deleted, but you know, just sitting here listening to you read it out loud, it makes me realize that I had always wanted to write about Hal's vision. I always wanted to write about that quote, and the book is about that quote. If you really, I mean, you zoom out, you read the book, you realize that it's about that. It's trying to explain that one quote. The whole book is dedicated to that one quote, and it's a special. Yeah, it's brilliant. And I love knowing that I know something that Hal didn't know now, because he couldn't see SegWit and Lightning. Mm-hmm. He didn't see that. He saw why we needed it, for sure. He showed us why we needed it, and he knew that we would. But he didn't know that it didn't even have to be Bitcoin backed currencies, but it would be smart contracts and time lock. And because time lock didn't exist when Hal was doing that. And,
right.
And that trips me out sometimes, thinking about Bitcoin being alive. And it's what people didn't realize when I was down the rabbit hole in 2016. I knew for a fact, people didn't know Bitcoin was getting better. They didn't know SegWit was coming and what it could do. They still don't know. They don't know that Taproot's going to do all that. And I don't know. I actually haven't spent the time. I knew what Lightning Network was going to do for Bitcoin innately. And a part of, I wrote an article, why I quit the bond market for Bitcoin, Lightning Network. And that was a true statement. That was a true article that I wrote. I don't know what Taproot's going to do for Bitcoin capital markets in the way that I had the conviction of Lightning, but it's growing. And Hal didn't know about time lock. He didn't know about SegWit or about Lightning. and suspending your Bitcoin within another Bitcoin network, not locking them in a bank and issuing an altcoin or a stable coin on top of Bitcoin as a layered money system, but actually, a native layered money system with Lightning Network because of the upgrade. So it's amazing to think about, and I still get revelations thinking about that, and so that's why I had to stop and go back to the.
No, no worries. Yeah. It causes two thoughts to come to my mind. One is, I remember studying with a mentor, and he was trying to go over with me like, when is something created? So if like you're buying a house, do you buy that? Like, do you come up with the image in your mind of the house you want, and then you go find it? So you've created the house in your mind, or does the house get created when you find it? And in that regard, I feel like maybe, Hal saw or created Lightning. It just didn't come into existence yet. He saw what was needed, and I'm going to change up the question a little bit, but I'd love for you to tell us what happened in 2008 when we broke the buck.
Yeah, money market funds are instruments. They're monetary instruments. And you can think of it like a placeholder. Like, I can't get US Treasuries right now, but if I get this money market fund share, it's a placeholder because it owns Treasuries and it owns other really high quality things. And if I own the share of the money market fund, I de facto own all these safe things. And so it's worth a dollar. It's all a dollar is worth a dollar in a money market fund. Well, when Lehman went under, the Lehman debt was owned by a lot of these money market funds. And so there was a particular fund that owned Lehman paper. And when the paper defaulted, the assets were not worth a dollar per share anymore. They were worth 97 cents or lower. And to think that a money market fund share could trade less than a dollar wasn't only not heard of, but it's assumed that it trades at a dollar or else the system falls apart. Because that 3 cent difference actually breaks the whole financial system because of leverage and other things and chain reactions. And so going from a dollar to 97 cents on that one money market fund share price broke the dollar system forever, in that the Fed had to come in and make sure that never happened again. So eliminating price discovery. And they've had to roll out dozens of facilities and over the course of a dozen years to make sure that that never happens again. But still things keep breaking, so they have to fix different parts of the system. And I don't have any doubt that the Fed will continue to keep things trading at par, meaning, they'll keep everything at a dollar that needs to be at a dollar for the system to work well. But if we didn't have them, the price would not be par, things would fail. And, our financial system would look a lot different than it does, differently than it does today. And that's kind of the conundrum.
Right. It's so interesting how these little blips, or what aren't little, are actually little, no, in actual size. Like LTCM, long-term capital management, what, $3.4 billion. I don't know when we broke the buck how much money was on the line in that one particular vehicle, but it seems like they're willing, or they need to spend a couple of billion, or a few billion, or several billion to protect the whole thing. And, I'm kind of curious what you think about, every 5 or 10 years of our lives, there's been an economic crisis. And then the last crisis seems to be health related, but the timing is around sort of credit cycles, it seems like. I'm just kind of curious, do you think this is going to play out for another 20, 30 years of these huge economic crises that everyone who's not on Bitcoin is going to be majorly affected by? Or is there sort of a crisis that's coming that's going to kind of be the beachhead to a new system?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I do believe that they'll keep happening and the Fed will keep making sure that nothing breaks by by providing more stimulus. It comes down to also volatility suppression, which is a way more technical thing when you analyze what the Fed is doing. When they buy risk, they are removing volatility from the market.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
And the vol suppression by what they purchase or intend to purchase, it changes everything, because if you don't have volatility, then you don't have price discovery and you don't have reversion to the mean, things like that. So I don't know if we'll ever have volatility revert to its mean as it stays suppressed. And again, that gets into optionality, what the Fed owns, what the Fed promises to buy. And listen, they're going to eventually have to taper their QE, reduce their purchases, because if we look at reverse repo today, we see that there's way too much cash in the system. It's actually nonsensical, the type of reverse repo numbers that the Fed is doing, over the last few days, $800 billion today. It just means that they've gone way too far on the QE side. So they'll have to reduce QE, which means they'll introduce volatility back into the market. And then they'll realize that it's breaking again and they'll have to do more QE. And so how long can this keep going? I don't know. Again, it goes back to the exit. We have chosen Bitcoin as the exit because I'm exhausted by it, Cedric. It's part of the reason why I resigned. It is exhausting to see the Fed and just, you know, everybody hanging on every word of the Fed. That's not a free market, and it's not exciting either. It's a snooze and it's disappointing. For innovators and forward thinkers, it is, it's frustrating because the things that should fail are not.
Right.
Societal impacts aside, why does the banking system get bailed out and rescued when they've designed a system that is, just rampant with fragility? It's not fun. Forget fair or not fair. It's not fun.
Right.
And Bitcoin is fun because it's this level playing field. And no boardrooms, no committees. And I love that about Bitcoin.
Yeah. It's interesting. You say no boardrooms, no committees, and the Fed. And, we're entering this phase where I think we're going to see more helicopter money, more forms of UBI. It's almost boring to talk about. But I'm kind of curious, in your latest research and studies, what do you think the impact on Bitcoin will be on China? And what do you think that their long-term reaction would be? I know we might get caught up in some of the local news and things that are happening on a week-to-week or month-to-month basis, year-to-year, but I don't know what their long-term plan is. I'm not saying you do either, but maybe studying their history has given you a gleam of what's to come.
My best guess is that China wants Bitcoin. They want to own it. Because they've reached the conclusion that many of us have, which is that Bitcoin is going to be at the center of our monetary system in the future.
Right.
It would surprise me if they didn't believe that already. And I do believe that they do. Layered money is getting translated by an economic think tank over there. And so I've gotten to talk to, Chinese people, and they've explained to me that we understand cryptocurrency technology really well. And we think that there's a place for it. So I think that China will treat Bitcoin, oddly enough, the same way that we treat it here in the United States. You'll have politicians bickering about regulating it. and you'll have the people recognizing that we have to own it and build businesses with it to compete in the future. And this idea that China hates Bitcoin because they're communist and Bitcoin is a free market tool, it's way too simplistic of a take to me. It doesn't capture any of the nuance for, like, the Nick Carter article on the high voltage transmission network that China's building and why Bitcoin miners were competing with industrial energy usage and why that might have been the cause for a strategic decision to replace Bitcoin mining with other things. That was a great article because it's so nuanced in showing you that this isn't about China hating Bitcoin because they're communist. I just don't see that. And I don't even see that communism is that important to them in the grand scheme of things. What's important to them is China and their position in the world.
Right.
And their status and their stature as a geopolitical power going forward. And they're going to need Bitcoin to, like, they can have their own internet to have their, you know, society function and their own social networks and all that kind of stuff. But having their own Bitcoin in the global context, and people thinking that the Chinese central bank digital currency is the ultimate goal for China and why they don't want Bitcoin in their country, that also doesn't make sense to me. They want their digital renminbi, but they think of Bitcoin as potentially a great investment opportunity. Yeah. So I'd like to see a lot more proof in the pudding before we, before we can say that China hates Bitcoin.
Sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think it's going to be very interesting how things play out. And I think that we have to take a longer term view over different societies and countries' reactions to what's happening on the ground. I apologize for the rain and the wind behind me. I am sitting outside. My final question for you is, how does Bitcoin sort of bring a renaissance to money and introduce a new denomination to the accounting of money?
Yeah, it's really, it's the most fascinating thing about Bitcoin is that it's changing the way that we anchor our nation has the Latin root nomen, which means name. And we are naming our earnings and our, you know, labor now in Bitcoin instead of dollars. And that is a shift in mindset. Denomination is a mindset. It's not just jurisdictional or related to where you were born. And so, you know, if your goal is to, you know, let's say your goal in 1998 was to own as many Apple shares as you could possibly own, because with whatever salary that you earned, because you said, you know, I just want to be married to Apple's growth, and I think that they have tech that's going to change the world. You've denominated yourself in Apple shares. You've done very well for yourself. But that's not something that people did. They wanted to own more Apple shares, but they weren't denominating their life's work in shares of Apple or percentage of, you know, ownership of the Apple company. But maybe some people did. Well, that's being replicated in Bitcoin, but now with, you know, tens of millions of people, and we're going to approach 1 billion people over this decade. Right? Bitcoin users. You know, that's giving us 9 years left in the decade. Yeah. That's the direction we're going. And that's a redenomination of the planet in a way that's way beyond 300 million Americans denominating in dollars, and then maybe an ancillary 500 million people from around the world that think in dollars because they're international businessmen and women. Yeah. This is a different type of redenomination. It's a whole mental mind shift. It's only something that you can appreciate when you're really just going after more BTC. And so people that are in it know it, and right. people that are not think of it as an asset, not yep. not a denomination. They can't see that. So they say, "What are you going to sell? What are you going to sell? What's your target price?"
Right.
It misses the point.
Yeah, I think if it's converting my dollars into Bitcoin, I accumulate Bitcoin forever. It's not something I trade or I'm ever trying to get out of. It's really interesting that, you know, tonight we've talked about like the dollar demise and what that means and how long that might take and how uncertain that story is. And we've talked a lot about how, or what I got from your book actually beyond the layers of money was that cash has no utility, right? So what we consider cash though, if I won $1 billion in the lottery, I can't deploy that in cash. I can't secure that in cash. It's just impractical. There's no real utility to cash per se on a large scale. So I've learned an incredible amount from your book. I enjoyed this conversation immensely. As the rain pours down behind me, please let everyone know where they could find you on Twitter and where they can get your book.
Cedric, it's been a great chat. I appreciate you having me on, and thanks for your patience in getting this on the calendar. People can check out my book, Layered Money. It's on Amazon and all over the internet. It is on Audible as well, read by Guy Swan, who did a fantastic job, and thrilled to be in business with Guy on the audiobook. You guys can find me on Twitter at Time Value of BTC. LayeredMoney.com has links to the book on Amazon and around the world. And reach out to me.
Yeah, man. This has been so dope, Nick. I'm going to run inside before I get rained on. But thank you so much, man. This has been incredible.
Nick Bhatia on the hierarchy of money, economic dogma, and monetary science right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And this episode is brought to you by our first sponsor, Ledin, L-E-D-N. Ledin.io is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. Ledin.io is the first digital asset lender with transparency and security of a formal proof of reserves attestation, raising the bar in the space. If you want to see what it's all about, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. And if you become a Ledin user and take a Ledin loan, you and I each get $25 USDC. I'm excited to learn and share more about Ledin.io. Thank you for tuning in 100. Stack sats and stay humble. This is Ced. Peace.